The following Dharma talk was recorded in March 2015 in St. Louis, Missouri. It is one of eight recordings from the retreat called The Four Messengers and the Message, taught by John Yaffe and Bridget Rollins. The retreat was sponsored by Mid-America Dharma. If you like this recording, you can find more talks at www.midamericadharma.org. For questions, we welcome your emails sent to info@midamericadharma.org. John Yaffe began practicing insight meditation in 1999 and has been a co-leader of St. Louis Insight Meditation Group since 2006. John is a student of Matthew Flickstein and has served on the Mid-America Dharma Board of Directors since 2005. Bridget Rollins has practiced insight meditation since 1997. Her mentors include Matthew Flickstein, Ginny Morgan, and Gloria Terania Ambrosia. Recognized by the Spirit Rock Teachers Council as a community Dharma leader, Bridget shares the Dharma through classes, workshops, and retreats.
Yesterday, Bridget shared with us some of the Buddha's instructions, I believe from the Satipatthana Sutta, about being fully mindful in all different kinds of daily events, the going forth and returning from alms rounds, in the case of his bhikkhus, all the different postures, even things as simple and mundane as, I believe the expression was urinating and defecating. So reflecting on that, I realized I have a poem about that. That I wrote a ways back. It's called Bathroom Insight. So I thought I'd share that with you. The paper tears, and the first noble truth is written in brown on these fingers. Dukkha sometimes clings to us, a variation on the second. Still, it's nothing personal, and isn't that the third? Except what is. Wash your hands. What's next? And while we're doing poetry, and not wanting to leave you with that, I do love Rumi. Sometimes I describe myself as ruminating. Anyway, sorry. Anyway, there's this wonderful poem. I'm going to finish with one of his poems as well, but this is called The City of Saba. And it speaks to the work we have to do to actively seek to awaken because of the nature of our society and the richness, if not in the kind of opulence that surrounded the Buddha in his period of being sequestered, but in all of the stimulation we have readily available, all the easy distractions and numbing devices and entertainments and substances. This is called the City of Saba. There is a glut of wealth in the City of Saba. Everyone has more than enough. Even the bath stokers wear gold belts. Huge grape clusters hang down on every street and brush the faces of the citizens. No one has to do anything. You can balance a basket on your head and walk through an orchard, and it will fill by itself with overripe fruit dropping into it. Stray dogs stray in lanes full of thrown-out scraps with barely a notice. The lean desert wolf gets indigestion from the rich food. Everyone is fat and satiated with all of the extra. There are no robbers. There is no energy for crime or for gratitude. And no one wonders about the unseen world. The people of Saba feel bored with just the mention of prophecy. They have no desire of any kind. Maybe some idle curiosity about miracles, but that's it. This over-richness is a subtle disease. Those who have it are blind to what's wrong and deaf to anyone who points it out. The city of Saba cannot be understood from within itself. But there is a cure, an individual medicine, not a social remedy. Sit quietly and listen for a voice within that will say, be more silent. As that happens, your soul starts to revive. Give up talking and your positions of power. Give up the excessive money. Turn toward teachers and prophets who don't live in Saba. They can help you grow sweet again and fragrant and wild and fresh and thankful for any small event. So my last talk is called Forgiveness, Don't Blame the Messenger. So we're talking about forgiveness, and I'll talk about it in the traditional sense, but I do want you to have an appreciation that forgiveness really exists on a continuum with other wholesome qualities, patience, loving kindness, acceptance, just a variety of things, which I don't know that I can describe in a linear progression, but they're all part of the terrain of the same geography. So while I may be talking about forgiveness, and forgiveness may have a particular association in your mind, typically one person forgiving another person for an injustice, it really has a much richer set of associated qualities with it. So try to be open with that. My last talk looked at the messengers in terms of what they can teach us, pointing as they do to their underlying traits of impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and the impersonal nature of conditioned phenomena, including us. Their lessons, the message of the messengers, can free us from the resistance and the delusional attachments we hold that distort our experience of both time and substance. The way we hold memories of the past and the thoughts we form about the future. Inspired by these messages and insights, we can form more wholesome and skillful intentions. These will play out here and now, of course, because that's where everything plays out, but will be informed by and in turn will influence our entire life and all who are touched by us. As the messengers remind us that life and thus we are impermanent, we realize it is precious and that we don't want to waste it in the unwholesome thoughts and actions that we so easily fall into. Which does bring me to the topic of forgiveness. If we want to live our lives in wisdom, right action, and settled clarity of mind, it is tremendously helpful to let go of condemning judgment and resentments. Here's a definition of forgiveness from Jack Kornfield. Forgiveness is the heart's capacity to release its grasp on the pains of the past and free itself to go on. I like reflecting on that definition because I get pulled in by this phrase, the heart's capacity to release its grasp on the pains of the past. Why do we do that? Why would we grasp pain? And yet we do. Matt Flickstein, certainly my primary teacher, used to teach, or still does probably, that unresolved resentments are the greatest single impediment we face to spiritual growth. Matt posits a model wherein we need to develop a healthy, open sense of self as a prerequisite for taking the spiritual journey, which involves transcending the self. And we can get misled in our readings. We read about the principle of non-self in Buddhism, and we think, well, I can skip the whole self thing because I'm getting past it anyway. But it doesn't work that way. There is, in some sense, a cosmic joke that you have to have a refined sense of self before you're ready to walk away from it. We can use the Buddha's metaphor of the raft to clarify that. And most of you will be familiar with that. He was teaching about the importance of not becoming attached, even to the most valuable things we encounter. So he was speaking actually of his own teachings, but he described a person or people on a shore needing to cross a body of water, and they would build a raft in order to do that. And of course, crossing a body of water, that raft was vitally important. It had to be built with care, had to be watertight, might even become an object of pride. You might decorate it, put a nice prow head on it or something like that. But when you get to the other shore, you don't take the raft with you everywhere you go. It becomes a burden at that point. So he was talking about his own teachings, which is a bold thing to be talking about since that's what he offered us. And he was saying, these two serve a purpose. Perhaps they serve a vital purpose. But we have a responsibility to be mindful even of our relationship to these teachings and these tools and these things we find valuable, to recognize when we've already gained that which we have to gain from them, and the point at which continuing to cling to them and use them and drag them around with us becomes a burden rather than a gain. This applies to the sense of self as well, or anything we build and acquire on life's journey. To flesh out Matt's position a little more fully, he points to the need for both psychological health, the healthy sense of self, and moral conduct in our behavior as foundations needed for making progress on the spiritual path. With respect to our past, the marker of psychological health is freedom from preoccupying thoughts and resentments. The marker of skillful moral conduct is that we are free of guilt and remorse. Why does the past have such impact on our spiritual well-being? Perceptions and memories of injury at the hand of another typically are followed by the arising of anger. This can fuel a desire for revenge, which can lead to unwholesome thoughts or actions, which in turn can lead to guilt or remorse. So this is a layering both in thought and action of the type I was describing earlier that becomes more and more solid as it layers up and becomes more and more difficult to get through or let go of. What else can we do with anger? Oh, we can stuff and repress it, in which case, over time, it builds up and solidifies into resentment. Because we haven't gotten rid of it, resentment becomes something we carry with us most everywhere we go. Being obsessively preoccupied with them, perceived injustices become a burden we carry, weighing down our spirit, coloring and distorting what we see, think, and feel, souring the flavor of life. Or, if we continue considering possibilities, we can find a safe way to release our anger, harming neither ourselves nor others, and forgive persons we perceive injuring us. Forgiving brings freedom in the present from our conditioned patterns of reacting to thoughts of the past. In effect, it's saying, whatever reactivity arose in the past, whatever was done to me and however I reacted to it, caused by thus and such, I am now not caught by or held in it. This mind is now free of it. The Buddha described directing anger or hatred at another as like a person who picks up burning coals with his bare hands to throw them at someone else. Even if there is success in striking the other person, the one picking up the burning coals to begin with must surely be the first one burned. You cannot harm another without first harming yourself. Conversely, and the good news in all of this, is that even when forgiveness is directed to another, offered to another, the first person to benefit, to be freed by that forgiveness, is the one doing the forgiving. Easily said. This area of practice requires a degree of courage, as does all our practice, but even so, this area requires courage. How so? Well, first, courage may be needed in order to trust the person being forgiven, on a practical level. Is it safe to forgive this one? Maybe not entirely. But this can be addressed by a number of strategies. For example, by setting boundaries about further interactions. Even if necessary, putting some distance between you and that person or set of circumstances. And more importantly, protecting ourselves is really a separate act from the act of forgiving. And that can be hard to see. Forgiving speaks to letting go of the pain associated with the past, but protecting ourselves or others is focused on assuring safety in the future. You can make a case that protection needs to be planned for, but they are separate matters. There's another area of courage directed internally, which we can bring to forgiveness. And this is more important in the spiritual realm. And that is being willing to look closely at and investigate the intentions motivating the forgiving. Intentions have a very strong influence on karma, and karma has a strong influence on consequences. In fact, it's integral to consequences. The forgiving self perceives an injury at the hand of another, and given the presence of self, there is likely a dramatic story about that injury. A story that spotlights the self in center stage. I am the person who has been wronged. I am the victim here. In forgiving, the painful grip of that perception is reduced. But we still, even so, need to look closely to see how wholesome the process is, because it can vary. So here's a continuum of intentions organized for the sake of presentation from least to most wholesome. At least that's what I was shooting for. We'll see how well I do. The first thing that can be present as a driving force, as an intention, is our love of melodrama. It may be that forgiveness doesn't end the story at all, but rather continues it, intensifying the dramatic opportunities by adding new plot lines. The injured person now rises above petty emotions to reveal moral superiority, bestowing on the perpetrator the blessings of a saint or a martyr. The contents of such a story may be noble, prettier, and easier to bear, but there may be no relaxation of the sense of self. So the relief is likely to be short-lived. Such a person can wind up with fresh storylines and resentments reinforced. I forgive and I forgive, and what does it get me? More abuse. Actually, I have to segue just a little bit to remember the discussion yesterday after Joe's talk on Donna, where he mentioned that for convenience sake, we wanted checks made out to just one of us, not both. When I took my cushion, I joked and said that it's really too bad that I'll be getting all that money and Bridget won't be getting any of it. And she said, but my, and I don't know her exact words, but she said, my nobility will be all the greater. And I said, that's fine. You take the mobility, I'll take the money. But you can see that even though, you know, I think there was pleasant ribbing going on there, but that's the kind of melodrama I'm talking about. You know, her saying, fine, I get nothing, but look at my nobility in enduring getting nothing. So, it's really not hard to find that at work. It's hard to find it as humorous as that at work, but it's not hard to find it. So the next thing, setting melodrama aside, is emotional bargaining, where forgiving isn't so much a letting go and a releasing as it is a transaction, a negotiation, an economic decision. We expect something in return, maybe from the person being forgiven, maybe from a larger set of people who are witnesses to it. Others can be forcing us. You know, people are saying, you really need to forgive that person. You know, you need to move on with it, blah, 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 to avoid punishment. Others say you should. It's expected. Others are watching. You're seeking rewards or positive acknowledgement for your nobility. You're satisfying minimum requirements for being in some sort of club, etc. Slightly other level, more internally, is that we can believe it's the right thing to do, and we're negotiating with our own self-image. It fulfills the self-image or identification of you or me or us being good people. You know, good people forgive. So, all right, I'll forgive. More economics, now directed to the person forgiven. It can be a return to civility, a truce. It can be a return to reciprocity, an alliance. It can be a return to intimacy, a renewal of vows, to be an ongoing relationship. So those are all forms of spiritual bargaining. Not to say that they're inherently bad or evil or wrong, but to argue that we should be aware of it and see what else is present as well, and decide more mindfully about how wholesome this decision is. The next in this continuum would be a kind of bargaining we call spiritual bargaining as opposed to emotional. So this can be wisdom-based. We can have a deep understanding from our knowledge of the sutras or other religious or spiritual influences that it's the right thing to do. Forgiveness will free the spirit, and I want to be free. And at the very deepest level, perhaps the most wholesome, is forgiving that comes from an awakened mind. We can forgive because we recognize that we have recovered from whatever the injury was. I've recovered, so I can forgive. Another level could be I recovered and I even grew from the experience itself or the experience of working it through. And so, not only can I forgive, I can even experience a certain degree of gratitude. If not for the person or that person's actions, at least for the resilience and the strength discovered and the growth. And the last level, which I believe is the most profoundly spiritual, is recognizing that we haven't been hurt at all, ever, because there was no one present to be hurt, or another self present to do the hurting. Matt Flickstein, another of his Flicksteinisms, I'm not sure how to describe it, but he says, wisdom knows there's no self there to experience pain, but the open heart and compassion knows that it hurts anyway. It's worth being really mindful of. I'd like, with those as sort of a setup, things to reflect on now, perhaps later, I'd like to offer you a guided reflection. So let me ask you to set down your pens for a moment or two. That's true, too. Yeah. So this, you know, I'd like this to be a guided meditation, but it's really more of a guided reflection because it's inviting some degree of discursive thinking on your part to come up with some of the things I'm asking you to visualize, and then hopefully, if the pacing is right, offering you enough time in the process to sort of recognize what's there in a discursive sense and then open to it with your heart and mind. So in your seated posture, let me begin by simply giving you a moment or two to connect with and follow the rise and fall of the breath. And then I will ask you to consider an area of your present life where you experience a sense of injustice or unfairness, where you have a clear sense of having been wronged. This can have arisen from the actions of another person, or the cause may be more out of reach or impersonal, an accident or illness, perhaps a social injustice, something you simply feel isn't fair or just isn't right. What are your thoughts about who or what is at fault? Is it one person or a group? Is it fate or nature or maybe even God? Are there other people or factors also at fault? Were others indifferent to your suffering or enabling to the perpetrator? Persons who should have prevented this from happening, or persons who should have intervened or perhaps comforted you after the fact? Is the sense of injury singular and focused, or does it touch and influence broad areas of your life? Anger, indignation, fear. What feelings arise when you get in touch with this sense of wrong? Give yourself a few minutes to let these feelings arise freely. Recognize and perhaps label them, and then see if others arise in succession. How do you handle such feelings? Do you express these feelings to others or hold them inside? Some people deny them. Some cover them up with busyness. Some with stimulating recreation, productivity, actions that numb the mind, and so forth. How do you handle them? What do you want by way of resolution? Do you want payback or revenge? Do you want to fix the problem? Do you want to comfort others with the problem? What do you want? You may recognize your feelings or thoughts in several of these list items, or many others may come to mind. Recognize that mind is constantly in process, that many feelings and thoughts can arise, do arise, that you can have many alternate views of what happened to you and what should be done about it. This profusion of thoughts, the Buddha called it papancha, can be confusing, troubling. There may be no single solution, no single release. Why can't things be simpler? Now, consider forgiving this person or situation. Picture in your mind becoming free of all these thoughts, these judgments, these feelings. Consider instead finding yourself at peace, being at ease, completely at ease. Breathe in ease. Breathe out peace. Breathe in ease. Breathe out peace. You may find this challenging. You may need to feel more safe with this. And if so, consider what would have to change to set your mind at ease. What boundaries would you need to set? What understandings would need to be achieved? Or what distance would you need to put between you and this person or circumstance for you to be at peace? Picture taking these steps. Visualize taking care of yourself at the level you need and deserve. Concerns about the future can be wisely addressed, if not completely, enough for the effort to be worthwhile. We can change what can be changed. We can come to accept the inevitability of what is inevitable. We can breathe in ease, breathe out peace. So hopefully, some or all of this is working within you. I can't know which thoughts, if any, resonated with you. But whatever worked or didn't work for you in this exercise, I hope you recognize how helpful it can be to look at resentments clearly, to allow yourself to see and investigate what's true for you with courage and compassion and as much forgiveness as possible. For all the difficult persons and conditions that touch you. Buddhist morality can be very expansive. You're probably already well aware of that from being in other retreats and teachings. In the same sense, forgiveness can address much more than direct personal threats or injuries. So just to quickly remind you of this, which I mentioned earlier as well. So among the people and situations we can forgive, there is ourself for our perceived shortcomings. There is, of course, the other persons who we feel have treated us badly. There's other persons in the abstract, ethnic, religious, political, cultural, socioeconomic groupings of people. You could probably finish this expression, the people I really can't stand are those darn other beings known personally. Think of your reactivity, insects or spiders or snakes. Other beings in the more abstract, microbes, viruses, poison ivy. Non-being or material, things known personally, weather, disease, aging, death and dying. We can forgive cognitive and spiritual conditions, attitudes or beliefs that either we hold that are antithetical with other attitudes and beliefs equally in us or those of others, and even attitudes toward nature, God, and life itself. I think the three messengers really beg forgiving, which is why the theme of this is don't blame the messengers. If we take aging, illness, and death personally, it becomes a burden and a sense of, it's something we can create a sense of resentment about. We can feel cheated. There is an opportunity for forgiveness there with the fundamental fabric of reality, of existence. So who or what is the most important of these to forgive? And there's two perspectives I like to offer for answering this. There's a spiritual and theoretical perspective, and then there's a perspective that fits with our daily momentary practice. On the spiritual level, we have the forgiving of self and life. We can't transcend the sense of self that we hold in aversion and resentment. We won't merge gracefully with the great unity of life if we hold life in aversion and resentment. If we forgive on these levels, the personal and the cosmic, we have a very good chance of dealing well with the resentments that fall between these extremes. But on the level of our daily practice, it's very simple. Whatever presents itself is dearest and most worthy of our attention. Judy Morgan, a very beloved, now gone, now past, Dharma teacher, whenever she took questions from people in a group, would begin by saying, "Yes, dearest." And I remember listening to her and thinking, well, that's just sort of some sweet artifact of her style. And then I raised my hand and she called on me and she said, "Yes, dearest." And I felt it. For her, whatever was immediately present, whatever had her attention in the here and now, was dearest to her. And when you felt it, you knew it. It was authentic. And this can be true not only with that which we love and are open to in a positive sense. It can be true with the things we're struggling with. They can be the things we hold dearest as well, because they're what's here. So I think I've made a good case that forgiving is a big topic. And unfortunately, it's hard to talk about without pointing at the darkness. If for no other reason than to say, let's not go that way. As I come to the end of this talk, let's turn back to the messengers and the message. The messengers are the grand arc of life reminders of our mortality. Stuff happens to us and we die. Stuff doesn't happen to us and we age and then die. How else could it be? There is no view of life you can come up with that doesn't have trade-offs and doesn't have an ending. If you come up with some, talk to me after the retreat is over, but I don't think you're going to. Of course, we do everything we can to mitigate suffering, but we learn as we age and hopefully grow in wisdom that our actions must be skillful to avoid making things worse. And in order for us to act skillfully, we need to see things clearly. The message the messengers bring is simple. Yes, we age. Yes, we die. Since life is finite, life is precious. Moreover, no matter how long we've been around, each moment of our experience is new. This moment is new for us. This moment is new for everyone around us and beyond our reach. This moment is new for the universe. This moment is new. You may grasp things and experiences, and you may hold them, but newness is very short-lived, so grasping is ultimately defeating. The newness of what we hold dissipates, and by grabbing it, you've broken its connection with the flow of life, which revitalizes that newness. If you really want to have what's new and fresh, you have to let go and keep letting go, or never cease to begin with. You can't capture the flow without killing it, so better to go with it. So I'd like to finish with a Rumi poem. I'll say a few words about it. It's not real long, but it does have a few little segments to it, and I want to help you with the transition. It's called The Sheik Who Lost Two Sons, and it's ostensibly about grief and about how there can be judgment as to whether people are grieving appropriately. And I think we've all bumped into that, where you look at somebody and say, oh, they're, you know, the grief is owning them. They need to learn how to let that go and move on. Or we judge people because they're not grieving vividly enough to suit our sense of what's right for the circumstances. So the poem addresses this topic, but then it segues, and there's a little shift in the sensibility of what grief is. It's not so much grieving for the personal losses that are inevitable, such as death. It's grieving for the stuff in life which is not inevitable, which could be infinitely better than it is if people would simply become more mindful and more caring and more open. And it's arguing that if you want to grieve, this is, in a sense, a more appropriate object suitable for grieving, because this can be changed. And then it moves on to another aspect of discussing judging, even in spirituality. And it sort of acknowledges that even, you know, we look at a spiritual leader and we say, oh, he's too politically activist for me. I know he's a good guy, but I don't like the flavor of his spirituality. And then someone else is, you know, too personalized. You say, well, that's not addressing the problems humanity faces. So he's talking about that as well. Interesting poem. But it ultimately, at the heart of it, is forgiveness. So, the sheik who lost two sons. A great sheik has lost two sons, and yet he is not weeping. His family and his wife wonder at this lack of grief. Do not think that I am cold and uncompassionate. I don't weep because for me they are not gone. The eye of my heart sees them distinctly. They're outside of time, but very close by here, playing and coming to hug me. As people sometimes see dead relatives in dream, I see my sons constantly in this waking state. I am even more deeply with them when I hide for a moment from the world and let the sense perception leaves drop from the tree of my being. I weep for those who have ungrateful souls. I weep when boys throw stones at dogs. I weep for dogs who bite for no reason. Forgive the harm that anyone does. We are here to be a forgiveness door through which freedom comes. I weep when I ask that the door not be shut. Some attend to individual mercies and some to universal grace. Try to let them merge. Pond water eventually arrives at the ocean. One saint works and lingers in the lakes of personal life. Another plays without limits in the sea. So I thank you for your attention. And I hope that in this and in everything we've offered this week, and not that we're done, I hope that everything offered so far, there's been something you find helpful. Thank you.